Thank you, Father Wimmer, and thank you all for coming. Let me suggest that you would be you'll benefit by looking at the handout in the packet you have. Mine's the one with the chart and the picture. And we'll talk about these pictures. Through most of the 20th century, it appeared that Catholics had bypassed the supposed faith versus science controversy. In 1975, Father John Hardin wrote that Darwinism as such had only a minimal impact on Catholic thought, whereas it struck many believers in evangelical Protestantism like a tornado. It was the Belgian priest, Georges Lemaître, who first proposed the Big Bang Theory in the late 1920s. The Catholic Church took such pride in his theories that Pope Pius XI inducted him into the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in 1936. Not long ago, I saw a bumper sticker on a Catholic seminarian's car that read, "I believe in the Big Bang Theory. God spoke and bang, it happened." Last November, South Bend, Indiana held the first Catholic conference on geocentrism, the view that the sun orbits the earth, following on the self-styled Catholic apologist Robertson Jenness's 1,100-page volume, Galileo Was Wrong, the Church Was Right, published in 2005. And as for evolution, Father Hardin simply did not live to see the tornado. In early 2009, the Pontifical Academy of Sciences held a conference on evolution and theology in honor of the bicentenary of Darwin's birth. And in November, a counter-Roman scientific conference refuting evolution theory took place at the private Free University of St. Pius V. Northern Virginia's Colby Center for the Study of Creation gives creation science workshops to Catholic parishes across the country. Several factors converge to explain both the lack of crisis over evolution in the early and mid-20th century and the spike in controversy at its end in today, a controversy Benedict XVI has called absurd. Few lay Catholics read the Bible before the Second Vatican Council, so the clash between science and Genesis that some Protestants perceived simply was not an issue. On the other hand, once Catholics were enjoined to read the Bible after the council, they were typically given little in the way of positive theological exegesis of Genesis 1 and 2. Much of Protestant neo-Orthodox theology had already surrendered the understanding of the empirical world and of cosmology to scientists and retreated into morals and meaning. And this ready embrace of Darwin, for example, already in the late 19th century in mainline Protestantism, prevented the serious work of integrating science and religion of the sort St. Thomas Aquinas had done in the 13th century and Leibniz in the 17th. Catholic religious education embraced this same model. The average high school religion textbook or annotated Bible footnote did two things. It acknowledged that the ancient Israelites had a simplistic, naive view of the world that we were by no means obliged to accept, and it reduced the theological content of Genesis 1 and 2 to simple platitudes. Pope Benedict XVI, while still Cardinal Ratzinger, noted a catechism widely used in France that reduced the meaning of creation to the affirmation that, quote, "the first and final meaning of life is to be found in God," end quote. None of this was helped by this image that you have in your handout, which was published in the New American Bible St. Joseph's edition, which circulated widely in the United States. The impression given was that this was what Genesis 1 was trying to teach. No wonder the implied message was, "Oh, those silly Hebrews." Let's move on to the call of Abraham. But Catholics took to heart both the injunction in De Verbum to learn the Scriptures and the reasoning behind that injunction. De Verbum had quoted St. Jerome, "Ignorance of the Scriptures is ignorance of Christ." Citing Pope Leo XIII, De Verbum said, "The study of the sacred page is the soul of sacred theology." There had to be some theology worthy of the name within Genesis 1 and 2. Creation was at the core of Aquinas' theological thought and central to fundamental Catholic theology. Catholic readers of Genesis, eager for meat, turned, therefore, to more literal readings. Sometimes this took the form of turning to Protestant evangelicalism itself, as Catholic groups adopted Bible studies produced by the Navigators and similar movements. In other cases, Catholic writers themselves began to promulgate theological readings of Genesis that depended on a literal Adam and Eve, even if rarely on a literal 7 days. Both creationist readings of Genesis and recent arguments by scientist atheists that science renders Christianity bunk bow in the direction of science in treating the Bible as a scientific book, as if this were the only form of discourse worthy of acceptance. Other speakers in this series will address various aspects of this problem. I draw from the fact that we need a doctrine of creation without the distraction of a creationism a particular goal, which is to lay out in some detail the rich creation theology or protology that the Bible can provide when read as the Church has always proposed. St. Gregory of Nyssa said, for example, that the firmament of day two is, quote, the limit of perceptible creation, the boundary beyond which there exist intellectual creatures which have no form, nor size, nor limited place, nor duration, nor color, nor outline, nor quantity. Thomas Aquinas said, the manner and order according to which creation took place concerns the faith only incidentally, and with respect to these, Christian authors have different opinions interpreting the sacred scripture in various ways. End quote. Aquinas had no intention of jettisoning his Aristotelian cosmology on account of a literal reading of scripture. And more recently, Pope Pius XII, in Humani Generis, 1950, said that much in Genesis 1 through 11, for example, was a, quote, simple metaphoric way of speaking, and that, quote, in what exact sense Genesis 1 through 11 comes under the heading of history is for the further labors of exegetes to determine. When Pius XII said way of speaking, he meant genre. Repeatedly, the documents of the Church stressed the need to read Scripture attentive to genre. Pius's own 1943 Divino Afflante Spiritu urged exegetes to, quote, discover what literary forms the writers intended to use. Dei Verbum affirmed, those who search out the intentions of the sacred writers must, among other things, have regard for literary forms. Certainly, God is omniscient and trustworthy. Certainly, God knows about hadrons, optically violent variable quasars, and quantum chromodynamics. But as St. John Chrysostom said, the ordinariness of the words is made necessary by our limitations. St. Ephrem the Syrian sang of that grace which bent down its stature to the level of man's childishness, as God works to clothe himself in our language so that he might clothe us in his way of life. So too Gregory of Nyssa, like a tender mother who joins in the inarticulate utterances of her babe, God gives to our human nature what it is capable of receiving and speaks in human language. Let me repeat, both creationist readings of Genesis and arguments by atheists that science renders Christianity bunk bow in the direction of treating the Bible as a book of science, as if this were the only form of discourse worthy of acceptance. Our society has reified science and history as self-evidently true and self-explanatory and the privileged forms of knowledge. But there are multiple kinds of truth. Philosophical truth, moral truth, religious truth. Poetry is truthful inasmuch as it deposits in its semantic expressions some authentic impressions of reality. As Paul Ricoeur said, Genesis 1 and 2 has more meaning than a true history. I will devote most of my attention to Genesis. This will therefore hardly give us a biblical protology or even an Old Testament protology. Creation appears in various places throughout the Old Testament, including creation language employed in cases where the intent was not to teach about creation, but about something else. But those two are witness to the creation thinking of the day. Nevertheless, most of these passages emphasize theological truths also presented in Genesis 1 and 2. Moreover, Genesis is where the science, faith, religion fight rages. And, as I will show, where science and faith were first brought into harmony. At the close of my essay, I will turn to the New Testament's teaching on creation. On the other hand, given the almost certainty that Genesis 1 and 2 originate separately, one must justify combining the two chapters as I am about to. The general view is that Genesis 2 is the older creation story from the so-called Yahwist source. In this case, the so-called priestly author of Genesis 1, or the final editor of Genesis, intends the reader to read the two stories together. At a minimum, this means a certain theology of Genesis 1 and 2 obtains at a redactional or canonical level. However, I think it is stronger than this. Scholars are increasingly drawing attention to the value of reading Genesis 1 and 2, or even 1 through 11, as a unit. In Genesis 1, the items of creation that God does not name are precisely the ones that man will name in chapter 2, with one exception. In Genesis 2, the refrain repeats, God saw that it was good. The ominous counterpart in chapter 3 is when Eve saw that it, the forbidden fruit, was good. There are several other examples. With this justification, the major theological points of Genesis 1 and 2 can be outlined, and that's the outline you have below the figure. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It is not a wholly satisfying translation, but it will suffice. The point here is that the universe exists. Science depends on this, and few would contest it, but the philosophy of solipsism, the world doesn't exist, it's all in my mind, has been around since Gorgias of Leontini in the 5th century BC. Second, the world has a beginning. We do not have to derive this simply from the admittedly questionable translation of the first words of Genesis 1, in the beginning God created. Genesis 2:2 says, the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the water. Chaotic waters are how all of the ancient Near Eastern societies envisioned nothingness. They have no concept of nothing, of zero, of a vacuum. Ancient Near Eastern creation stories, or cosmogonies, from Egypt to Babylon, if they go back to the very beginning, describe a watery chaos, when everything that now is was not. The world is what is ordered. Now, it is hard to find scientists today who do not think the universe had a beginning. Genesis 1 neither contradicts nor supports the Big Bang theory or whether there was a universe before the Big Bang, but it does run counter to any notion of reality as eternal, in the sense of without beginning. The third and most important truth of this verse, the first verse from Genesis 1, is that God is existing outside of and independent of creation. All other Christian doctrine depends on the distinction of God and the world. A literate citizen of the ancient Near East would have found the creation story of Genesis 1 awkwardly starting in media res. Where had this God come from? Most Egyptian myths and many Mesopotamian ones explained first the origin of the gods. The Bible has no such interest in theogony. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote, "No question can penetrate before God creating because it is impossible to go behind the beginning." As the rest of Genesis 1 unfolds, we find that God is the creator of everything. Israel broke with the mythology of its neighbors. The message is that the world is not a chaos of mutually opposing deities, that the sun and the moon are not deities, and the sky is not full of divinities, all of which modern physics and biology confirm, but that all of this comes from one God. The ancient Israelites were aware of the beliefs of their neighbors about the origin of the world and of humanity. The ideas of Mesopotamian myths like Atrahasis and the common themes of many Mesopotamian stories on the making of the human race are deliberately refuted in both Genesis 1 and 2, as we shall see. With one myth, however, the connection may even be stronger. Although scholars are by no means as certain as is often maintained, it is probable that the author of Genesis 1 knew the Babylonian Enuma Elish myth. The oldest copies we possess of the Enuma Elish are from 1000 BC, and it was likely composed at the earliest in the 16th century, not earlier. We can no longer refer to the Enuma Elish as the Mesopotamian creation story, as there are numerous creation stories much older and they look nothing like Enuma Elish. Its story is, on the surface, nothing like Genesis. The monster Tiamat, who is also the Chaos Sea, threatens to destroy the gods, and no champion can be found. Marduk, the god of the city of Babylon, offers to defeat her if he can become king of the gods. He is victorious, and from her now split carcass creates the world. When he's finished, he's declared king, and the gods build a temple home for him. The subtext is kingship, both of Marduk and the human king of Babylon, his installation as heir to the cosmic victory. The myth was ritually rehearsed in the New Year's festival. In the full Neo-Babylonian festival, the defeat of Tiamat and creation of the world were ritually linked to the enthronement of the Babylonian king. The king overcoming his enemies is homologous to the god of kingship overcoming the monster. And this myth and ritual complex lasted into the Persian and Hellenistic period. A century ago, Hermann Gunkel, building on the work of others, demonstrated the dependence of Genesis 1 upon Enuma Elish. Subsequent scholars have reiterated and honed the parallels. For example, the word used for the deep in Genesis 1-2, Tehum, in the singular without a definite article, must relate to Tiamat. Both Genesis 1 and Enuma Elish thus start with nothing but chaos water, described using the same lexeme. Genesis 1 knows the same threefold classification of land animals as Enuma Elish, and creation follows the same sequence of water, firmament, land, lamps, people, rest. Marduk creates simply by his word in Enuma Elish in Tablet 4. In Tablet 5, the purpose of the sun and moon is exactly the same as in Genesis 1. Humans are created with the phrase, "Let us make man," in Tablet 6. But if the similarities are proof of dependence, then the differences are even more striking. Genesis 1 has no violence, a point to which we will return, and Genesis 1 is unabashedly monotheistic. God alone creates, and all that is, he has created. This means that every created object is contingent. Duns Scotus said that nothing in creation is necessary, therefore everything is grace, an unmerited gift from God. There's another reason for highlighting the relationship between Genesis and Enuma Elish. The Babylonian story, weird as it may seem, was arrived at by observation, by science. It represented the best science known in the Near East at the time. The Israelite writer of Genesis 1 was thus working at the interface of science and theology. John Paul II said this in 1988, "If the cosmologies of the ancient Near Eastern world could be purified and assimilated into the first chapters of Genesis, might contemporary cosmology have something to offer our reflections upon creation? Does an evolutionary perspective bring any light to bear upon theological anthropology, the meaning of the human person as the imago Dei, the problem of Christology, and even upon the development of doctrine itself? What, if any, are the eschatological implications of our contemporary cosmology, especially in light of the vast future of our universe? Can theological method fruitfully appropriate insights from scientific methodology and the philosophy of science?" End quote. This is our challenge today, working in the footsteps of the so-called priestly writer of Genesis 1. There are many ways to view the relationship of science and religion, but the priestly writer would maintain, when we come to the concept of creation, we come to an area in which the relation between science and faith must be at its most intimate. Now turn the page over to the chart on the site. Genesis 1 is an elegant, finely crafted pattern. It is not prose. Its repetitions are ordered and its structure is unmistakable and tight. Time does not permit us to go verse by verse to see this inductively, but I do it every year with seminarians. The pattern is presented by the number of creative acts on each day, that's number of acts, whether the creation involves separation or not, whether the object is named by God, whether God has created the object directly or delegated its creation, as in, let the earth bring forth the living creatures, whether the object is said to be capable of producing more of its kind, and the verdict God declares over the creation. And this chart illustrates what this kind of analysis produces. This shows two sets of 3 days. In each set, there are 2 days of one created act each, and a third of two. The location of what is created in days 4 through 6 repeats days 1 through 3. The first 3 days give form to the formless, the second 3 fill the void, and so on. This is beautiful, and it clarifies some oddities in the text. The words of verses 20 and 21 indicate that the waters create both fish and birds. Quote, let the waters teem with the teeming living creatures and birds that fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. This was never intended to be a biological account of the world. Israel did not think the sea produced birds. Birds and fish must be created from the waters because day 2 and 5 are water days. Yet birds must be created on day 5 alongside the fish because they fill the sky created on day 2. The sun and the moon, not named lest they be considered gods, are created on day 4 because light is created on day 1. There is no contradiction here. The structures focus attention on the creation of humanity, with whose advent the entire world becomes very good. We will return shortly to what this says in making humans the penultimate climax of creation and the Sabbath its pinnacle. For now, let us focus on the mere presence of such an amazing pattern. Cosmogonies are never written to tell audiences about the primeval past. They are written to tell about the present nature of the universe. The 7 days are not a chronology of creation. They do not represent eras or stages. I think the point is the pattern. The meaning is that there is a rational wisdom to creation, coherence, a point that science also depends on. Israel cannot write philosophy. They cannot say the universe is rational, it is orderly. But they can say it through a literary pattern. Everything God creates is good, with the exception of the firmament, which I have never understood. This is fundamental theology. As intended, what exists is good. as the medieval theologian said, ends et bonum convertentur. None of God's creative acts appears difficult for him. He simply speaks. Put theologically, this truth is that without any resistance to his power, God creates. The formless and void, the darkness and stormy waters of verse 2 have led commentators to rely so heavily on ancient Near Eastern analogies as to call the chaos darkness a force which must be subdued in order for the Creator's design to come into being. However, creation by combat, theomachy, was never given canonical status in Israel, surviving only in shadowy references in the Psalms and Isaiah. In Genesis 1:21, even the Tanin, the dragon of the Canaanite dragon chaos myth, is reduced to a fish. Creation is good. There is no threat. And violence is an aberration. In fact, God does not so much command as invite in the jussive mood, let there be X. God creates in Genesis 1 by saying, therefore, in a certain sense, creation is revelation. Franciscan tradition in particular speaks of the book of creation. Reflecting back on what has been said about the creator-creation discontinuity, one might say that the only continuum from God to the creation is the Word. The structure of Genesis 1 is not uniform sets of 3 days. The second set has enough superlative tweaks on the first to present a crescendo towards the sixth day and the creation of the human person. The theological meaning of this is the special dignity of humanity. Genesis 1:31 says that creation as a whole becomes very good only after humans are created. In the biblical view, humanity is not intrinsically evil, as the Enuma Elish actually teaches, and is neither divine nor merely natural, but both, as Genesis 2 will clarify. A wide-ranging history of speculation has grappled with in our image after our likeness. What does it mean to be in the image and likeness of God? We can briefly categorize the options. One set of options interprets this substantially. Image and likeness is something humans have. Theologians speculate this might be a spiritual nature, that was Augustine and Aquinas, reason, the Jewish philosopher Philo said this, a moral nature, or even physical appearance. In any case, image and likeness cannot be limited to one aspect of the human person, the soul, for example. The text will not allow this. It is the whole person that is in the image of God. But the biblical text does not conform well to any of these substantial explanations. A second possibility is relational aspect. To be in the image of God means to have the capacity for a relationship with God. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber claimed this. Humanity's relationship to God then is not something added to human existence. Our very existence is our relationship to God. More textual support actually obtains for viewing the male-female relationship as the definition of image, as Bonhoeffer and Barth thought. The poetic structure of verse 27 is, God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. The rigors of Hebrew poetics demand that the new term, male and female, can only correspond to image of God, the term that is otherwise dropped out in the third colon. The context of the verses suggests a functional definition. The next verses grant humanity dominion over creation, in effect as God's vicegerent. We will return to this dominion shortly. Another possibility is that the philology of the relatively rare Hebrew words for image and likeness, tselem and demut, suggest an iconic or theophonic interpretation. A selem, image, is an idol. The Septuagint has icon here. And exegetes all note that a god's selem is not a picture of the god, but where the god can be encountered and truly worshipped. Thus, to say that we are the tselem of God is to make each other a place of encountering God. Not that people are God, but that how one relates to another is how one is relating to God. It is a small step from this to Matthew's Gospel's sheep and goats. Moreover, in the ancient Near East, the king was regularly a tsalam of the deity, his body double, sometimes also called Demut. This was true from 3000 BC to 600 BC. In that light, Genesis 1 is a radical democratization. Thus, this iconic definition does not exclude the functional dominion one. Royal functions are assigned to humanity in verses 26 and 28. Let them have dominion, but with no provision for having dominion over other people. The Enuma Elish ends with Marduk assuming dominion over the world. Baal becomes king at the end of the Canaanite Baal myth. But in Genesis 1, the one who assumes kingship at the end of the creation story is the human. The anthropology here is exalted. And we shall see that Genesis 2 will help us qualify this dominion. But note even here that although humans have dominion over the animals, they are not permitted to eat them. Verse 29 assigns only plants as human food. They don't get to eat them till Genesis 9. Dominion over animals is not a food chain. Genesis 1's image and likeness are complemented by Genesis 2, dust of the earth and breath of God. Both presentations affirm the equality of all humans. Royalty have no distinct creation story. We must not understand this episode as God placing a soul within a person. The text says God breathed into man and man became alive. Israel does not hold to a separable dualistic Descartes combination of body and soul. As John Paul II said, biblical anthropology does not distinguish in man body and soul, but rather body and life. Regardless of whether a poetic reading of 1:27 suggests men and women in relationship, image God, the verse certainly suggests an equality of sexes, an unity of the sexes. Now, to establish that this is a theological truth from Genesis, we must show that Genesis 2 does not dissent when it has man created before the woman. In Genesis 2, 18 through 20, the woman is man's ezer kenegdo, an awkward phrase that literally means helper like facing him. This is the King James Version's helpmeet, a helper fit for him. It's clearer in Spanish, como el que le ayude. The neged implies equality. And helper, ezer, only ever refers to God as a helper of man in Exodus 18:4. No one else is ever an ezer. Being made for man's side does not indicate subordination. Nor is the man naming his wife in the statement, "Let this one shall be called woman," which would indicate subordination. The author has gone out of his way to put this statement in the passive voice, "This one shall be called woman." Eve is not named by Adam until after Genesis 3's events. Similarly, regardless of whether a poetic reading of 1:27 suggests men and women in relationship image God, Genesis 2:24 through 25 indicates an innate eros. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Here is sexual concourse before the fall, if we may call it that. Saints Augustine and Didymus the Blind rejected the Platonic view of Saints Gregory and Nyssa and John Chrysostom and taught, like the rabbis, that if there had been no sin, there still would have been sexual intercourse in Eden. This verse about the man leaving his father and mother and cleaving to his wife also denotes a default monogamy, nowhere legislated in the Old Testament. Polygamy and celibacy are irregularities. A final piece of anthropology here in Genesis 2 is the primacy of work. Genesis 2:5, where, quote, "there was no man to work the ground," and 2:15, "God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to work it and watch it," indicate at least one of the reasons God created people was to till the soil and to avad, work, till, serve, and shamar, keep or guard, the garden. This complements the dominion of chapter 1, and it demonstrates that work is a fundamental dimension of man's existence on earth. The final theological message of Genesis 1 and 2 is that the pinnacle of creation's pattern in Genesis 1 is not humanity, but the Sabbath. It is the only creation that God declares not good, but holy. Genesis 2:2 states that God completed work on day 7, not day 6. The following verses clarify that his only work was creating. Therefore, he created on day 7. And what he created was the Sabbath. To understand what this means, we must remember that the Israel that received Genesis, that heard the stories, was an Israel that already knew what the Sabbath was. Whenever the Sabbath originated, it did not originate with this text. The Sabbath meant for Israel the day of rest, of human rest. In these verses of Genesis 2, they are now told that God also rested on the Sabbath. It is not too much to say that this added to the theology of the Sabbath, the idea that to keep the Sabbath was to emulate God, to live in His image and likeness. I would like to close with two creation passages from the New Testament. Colossians 1 includes a hymn that interprets the person and death of Christ Jesus in cosmological terms, rich with words taken from the Greek version of Genesis 1. The hymn begins, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by Him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through Him and for Him. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together." Now we see another understanding of Genesis 1's in the image of God. Christ is the true imago Dei, a calling humans could not quite live up to. And as the true likeness, which is the Vulgate of that verse, He is the creative agent or conduit through whom everything comes into existence. Moreover, creation is not merely an act by which the world came into being. It is a present sustaining. "In Him all things hold together" is the English Standard Version. The Vulgate has "in Him all subsist." Creationists think they are saving God as creator, but do not fight much about God as sustainer, even though Isaac Newton worried that gravity would undermine this article of faith. Might it be easier to avoid fights with science about what happened at the Big Bang or in primate evolution if we insist that God is the cause of all that ever comes to exist, including your next breath? Finally, John 1, which amounts to nothing less than a rewriting of the Genesis creation theology in the light of the Christ mystery. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was with God in the beginning. Everything came into being through the Word, and without the Word, nothing came into being. What came into being through the Word was life, and the life was the light for all people. The true light that shines on all people was coming into the world. The Word became flesh and made His home among us. We have seen His glory, glory like that of a Father's only Son." This builds on Colossians' hymn. God creating by His Word in Genesis 1, beginning with light. But Christ is not only an impersonal Logos, but a personal Son. And this Son, operative from creation, in the Message translation, moved into the neighborhood in the person of Jesus. The point is a fundamental unity of creation and redemption. For only when redemption is rooted in the origin of creation can redemption really be for all people. Thank you.